This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Ball Factory, a Japanese eatery and coffee shop at 95 Montrose Avenue in East Williamsburg. Learn more at brooklynballfactory.com.
This week on Meet and Three, meet four of our HRN Hall of Fame inductees. These prolific individuals are writers who have changed the way we talk about food. We'll take a look at the journeys that shaped their literary voices.
I was heading off into the unknown to spend my junior year of college in Paris.
We'll explore the culinary landscape they work within.
You know, it was that whole self-made American idea that you can just kind of create a new world from scratch, including a new way of eating.
And look at the transformative effect that their work has on what we eat and where it comes from.
It gets down to management deciding that humane handling is important. You've got to have management that cares. And if management doesn't care, then you're going to have a bunch of bad stuff.
You can learn more about HRN's 10th Anniversary Hall of Fame at heritageradionetwork.org/Hall of Fame. And don't forget to subscribe to Meet and Three wherever you listen to podcasts. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E.
Hello and welcome to Why Food, a podcast about innovators, entrepreneurs, and career changers who make up the food and hospitality industries. I'm Ethan Frisch, your lone co-host this week. Valerie is off doing something exciting somewhere far away from here. So I'm in the studio with Dan Giusti, who's the founder and CEO of Brigade. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So just in a nutshell, tell us what is Brigade?
Yeah, I mean, really in a nutshell, the idea of Brigade is that we are getting professional chefs who would otherwise choose to work in restaurants or hotels, for example, and choose to work in school kitchens and really rethink what school food can be.
What can school food be?
It's a good question. We've been doing this for 3 years, so we're still figuring that out.
Yeah. And you came, I mean, you're sort of different from our usual guest in the sense that most people we have on the show did something totally unrelated to food for, you know, several decades in some cases, and then switched and started a food business or became a chef or something like that. You switched within the food industry in a pretty significant way, and that we're going to get into that over the next hour. But tell us a little bit of the story. How did you get into the food business, and what did you do in your early days of cooking?
Yeah, I mean, I might have a stereotypical background to some extent. I come from a big Italian family. My father was born there. I grew up in New Jersey, in southern New Jersey, outside of Philadelphia, and I grew up with this kind of idea of food, that it was extremely important, but maybe more importantly, the hospitality surrounding food. I think everybody out there has someone in their family that, you know, come Thanksgiving or whatever holiday it may be, you want to go to their house. And then similarly, there are other people's houses you don't want to go to in your family. And I always attribute this to food when I was younger, but now I realize it's really just the hospitality. We have one aunt in my family that she is clear in a way the best cook, but she really just caters to everyone's needs. So going to her house is so enjoyable. Till this day, it's where I want to go. It's where I want to relax. And I didn't really realize that until later in life, but it was always about the food in the beginning. So as a young kid, we moved away from New Jersey when I was like 9. And I was just intrigued by the fact that my mother couldn't cook as well as my aunt. And my mother doesn't like to cook. So at a young age, 10, 11, I started kind of dabbling. And every time I would visit my aunt, I'd start cooking a little bit and I'd ask her questions. And I started realizing how challenging it was, even though she made it seem so simple. So that's where it all started for me. I took it as a challenge. I started cooking more and more. And surely by the time I got into high school, I was 14, freshman in high school, everybody's talking about college. And straight away, I just said, you know what? I want to be a chef. And I literally at that point didn't look back. I didn't really reconsider from that point moving forward. I just said I wanted to be a chef. I spoke to some folks who represented culinary schools. They said, get a job. I got a job at a local restaurant. At this point, I was living outside of Washington, D.C., restaurant serving burgers and crab cakes and things like that, very high volume. And I just loved working in a restaurant. I loved the atmosphere of working in a restaurant. Now, this was 2002. The Food Network was just kind of coming around. And of course, there wasn't anything like Netflix with all these shows. And so I didn't know of famous chefs or anything like that, or fine dining restaurants. We didn't go out to places like that. So for me, it was literally about the idea of kind of taking care of people, hospitality. I enjoyed that. And I loved working in a restaurant. It had nothing to do with all these other things. And then I went to culinary school.
What were some of those kind of family, classic family dishes that you grew up with?
I mean, it all kind of, I would say it all revolved around one thing, which was these tomatoes. So again, my aunt lives in South Jersey, and it is the Garden State, and most people really crap on New Jersey as a state. But quite frankly, if you're in South Jersey, any produce that you get on the East Coast in volume, if you're in Washington, D.C., if you're in Philadelphia, probably comes from Vineland, New Jersey, which is where she lives. It's all farms. Square mileage-wise, the biggest city in New Jersey. So, again, I said stereotypical. She's not the stereotypical cook. So every summer, we're approaching it now. It's in the next couple days or the next week where her farmer, she's 80 now. She's lived there for 40 years. Her farmer will call her and say, okay, we have the tomatoes. Tomatoes are ready. She keeps about 400 to 450 jars of tomato on hand at any given point. So these are preserved tomatoes that she jars herself all by hand, no machinery. It's her and her friend, and they've been doing this for years. And back in the day, she used to prepare the jars of just tomato, but also the jars of prepared sauce. So when we first moved away, we used to just get the sauce, and it was already made. Now, the sauce she makes is super simple. Like when people make, I think anyone who's properly Italian will tell you that a basic tomato sauce doesn't have oregano. A lot of times it doesn't even have garlic in it. So when she makes it, some of those things are usually reserved for pizza sauce, I should say. So when she makes tomato sauce, it's onions, it's carrots, it's celery, most of which are cut large, taken out. It's a bulk parsley that you take out and a couple leaves of basil and the tomatoes. The tomato is quite honestly the most important thing. Anyway, it looks like brainless, but I couldn't ever do it. So basically the whole, how things transpired is, we used to get the made sauce. I said, you know what? I want to make the sauce from now on. So she started giving us the tomato jars, and I just couldn't make the sauce. So just pasta with her tomato sauce, which I can make now, I'm proud to say, was one of the main dishes. Lasagna, I will say that the lasagna she makes, I've eaten lasagna in a lot of places. I lived in Italy for a year. I've eaten all kinds of lasagna. The lasagna she makes is so good. And the key to it, first of all, she puts no ricotta cheese in it. Our family is not a fan of ricotta cheese, but the key, and this is what I like about it, it's not like sloppy, like a lot of lasagna you eat, you get into it, and it's like this mess of like ricotta cheese and some kind of like ground meat, sausage, whatever. She makes meatballs. The meatballs are like smaller than a dime. She makes about 1,000 per lasagna. And the meatballs are beef, veal, and pork, and they roll out these tiny meatballs. So when you eat this, so first of all, she makes the pasta, the sauce, and the meatballs all in the same day, and then assembles it and cooks it. And it's this thing that when you get into it, it's just like, it's just kind of moist enough that it's delicious, but it's not messy at all. And it's so neat and well put together. So that's one. And then finally, tortellini. She makes tortellini and it's spectacular. So these are some of the kind of the key things she makes, yeah.
And you feel like you can, the sauce at least replicate
the
now.
Sauce I can make. I will say that once I got interested in cooking, unfortunately, I started working. And yeah. Since I've been working, I haven't had, I'm ashamed to say it, the opportunity to spend that much time with her to cook. So now, finally, now that I'm doing the work I'm doing now, I have a little more time. I go down there as often as possible and I spend time. So a few months ago, we went down and made a couple thousand tortellini. That's the other thing. When they cook. Like, for example, like people ask me now, can you come and do a dinner? And like, we'll get more into my background, but like if someone wants me to come do a dinner at a restaurant, I don't want to cook food that, say, I cooked at Noma. I want to cook the food of my family. So I was asked to do a dinner in Washington, and I said, well, I want to make tortellini and broth because it was the winter. So I called, her name is Zia Rosa. Zia means Anne. I said, Zia Rosa, I need to make tortellini for 150 people. And she doesn't even blink. She's like, okay, you're going to need about 2,000 tortellini. This is how much we're going to need. We need to make this much broth. Because she's like done that in her house. Yeah. She's made tortellini for, it's like, so all these things, it's so cool. So now I've been learning a lot of these recipes a little more firsthand, but I need to figure it out because it would be a real shame. You know, she's getting older that someone needs to kind of keep that going. And I would obviously be the one that should do it.
Yeah. All right. So let's get back to your background a little bit. You went to culinary school.
Yeah. Yeah. So once I went to culinary school very quickly, so I went to the Culinary Institute of America, and halfway through your 2-year program at the Culinary Institute of America, you have to go on an internship or an externship. They call it an externship. I never really understood that. I'm not really sure what the difference is. Anyway, that was where it all changed for me because, again, I wasn't super familiar with a lot of restaurants around the country. And I was, at the time, I was living outside of Washington, and now I was going to school about an hour and a half north of New York City. And it was basically like, if you didn't go to New York City to do your internship or externship, you were like, it was like a cop out. Like the whole point was you need to go and just get beat up in New York City. Like I remember there are people who were getting jobs in like resorts or hotels even, and that was considered like a cop out. It was like, you need to go to a fine dining restaurant where you're going to work 18 hours a day and you'll get work to the bone. So ultimately I ended up going to Oriole, which is a Charlie Palmer restaurant, which at the time was pretty popular and pretty well known. It's not so much anymore. And I went there and there was a lunch and dinner shift, and I was hired to be an intern for the lunch shift. And then the person who was working dinner quit. And they said, meet, you know, this, you know, naive 18-year-old kid, like, you want to work both shifts? And I was like, sure. So then I was working from like 7 a.m. to like midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning every day, and just like getting work to the bone. But I think by nature, I became addicted to it. I loved this environment. It was fast. It was busy. That year, I was there in the summertime. They extended restaurant week for the whole summer. Which was crazy. So then I was just like, I remember just literally, I would like fall asleep while working. Like I was just like a zombie. I had one day off a week on Sundays. And I remember I would just walk around the city with headphones on and do nothing. In my, I think I was here for 4 months. In my 4 months, I literally didn't do one thing. I never went to a bar. I went to the movies one time. Someone asked me to go to the movies, so I went to the movies. But I used to just put my headphones on, walk around, go back home, fall asleep, and then wake up the next day. And that was my existence in New York. But that's, for me, that's where the whole thing changed. Finished culinary school. After culinary school, I went to Italy. And I went to Italy. I worked in a one Michelin star restaurant in Northern Italy called Pinocchio, which was really interesting because I saw a whole different type of food than I was used to, where rice was actually more important than pasta. So it was a place where like people would come in, they'd order risotto, you started making risotto from scratch. So it's, you know, if it didn't take at least 20 minutes plus, people knew that it wasn't right. Like you took 20 plus minutes when someone ordered risotto. So that was like an interesting experience for me. I thought I'd want to live in Italy for the rest of my life because I grew up in an Italian family. And for me, I was like, I'm going to live in Italy forever. I couldn't wait to leave Italy. At this time, I was like 20, 21. I was living in a tiny town and I was just like, I need to get out of here. So basically from that point moving forward, I did a variety of jobs. I think the highlights being, soon after that, I moved to Las Vegas. I worked in Las Vegas in 2007, 2008. So that's when there was like this big onslaught of all these French chefs, Joel Robuchon, Guy Savoy. They went to, Vegas and opened restaurants. And I had been watching like Top Chef and like, there was a few people working there. So I'm like, I want to go work there. And I'd never worked in, you know, Oriole was like a fine dining restaurant, but still it wasn't like the top of the top. And these guys were coming from Paris and they had three Michelin star restaurants. And although it wasn't Paris, it was like a different level. So I went out there and I ended up working for Guy Savoy at Caesar's Palace. And it was like carpets in the kitchen, granite countertops. You know, we vacuumed the floors in the kitchen. We all had the Braggart uniforms, which were, you know, they're like $150 jackets. And we were just, I was just like a cook, you know. It was just like another level. It was something I'd never seen before. The products we were working with, the price of the menu, you know, they have soup. They're notorious for a dish of soup they have that's, it's artichoke and truffle soup. If you go to Paris, it's like 65 euros for a bowl of soup. And like, this is the kind of stuff, and I just never seen that. We would get deliveries of truffles, like $30,000 at a time, like a bag of truffles would show up. So then even more so, I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. I moved back to Washington, D.C. after that, and I became the head chef of a restaurant. So now I'm like 24, and I'm the head chef of this restaurant called 1789 in Washington, D.C. It's on the campus of Georgetown University. And to paint a picture of 1789, it's been there forever. And it's the kind of place that like either you're graduating from Georgetown, so you take your parents there. It's Easter, so you go there. It's Mother's Day, so you go there. Or you're like 90 years old. Like, that's the kind of place. Those are the people who eat there. At the time, it was like the only restaurant in Washington that still required you to wear jackets, which you can imagine in a town like Washington, that means a lot because you'd think like a lot of restaurants are that way, but they weren't. By that time, people are like, in the summertime in Washington, like, you're not going to get much business if you demand jackets. But people had to wear jackets there. And here I am, this like 24-year-old cocky kid from Las Vegas, trying to like do all this stuff. So I went in, they were serving, they were known for their Caesar salad, creme brulee, and rack of lamb. So that paints a picture as well. Yeah. And I took all those things off the menu. I'm trying to like change all this stuff and essentially spent like 3.5 years trying to change something that didn't need to be changed. It was a very successful restaurant. It still is a very successful restaurant. And I didn't realize why it was successful. So I tried to change all this stuff. And at one point, I was like, what am I doing?
And how did you wind up there as a 24-year-old, as the head chef of a restaurant like that?
Right. So 1789 Restaurant is part of Clyde's Restaurant Group, which Clyde's Restaurant Group is the organization that I worked for when I was in high school. And I did off and on work for them a little bit even after Italy. So it was like it's about a 12-restaurant restaurant group, and they have one fine dining restaurant. Strangely enough about Clyde's Restaurant Group, most people have never heard of it, but one of their restaurants, Old Ebbitt Grill, is actually like the fifth highest grossing restaurant in the United States, and they net like $36 million a year in sales, which is like astronomical for a singular restaurant. Yeah. So I did have a little bit of that experience through my career working in these very high volume restaurants, which was really, I think, key for me. But anyway, that's how I ended up at 1789. And again, I was just like, you know, after Guy Savoy, I never kind of saw that realm again. I would say at 1789, I had a PR person. I got great press. Like, I don't know if people understand how it works, but like, I was getting press I should not have gotten. I was getting nominated for like best new chef in Washington and this and that. And I was like, I was not a good chef. I wasn't a good chef at all. You know, looking back at it, and I was like nominated for all these awards, and like now I have an understanding of how these things work, and I think people don't understand that like, you know, if you have a press person versus if you don't. Yeah. If you don't, it's hard for you to win any awards. If you do, it's pretty easy. Yeah. It's just somebody pushing your name out there.
How did you find the transition from cooking to managing to now you're running a kitchen, which is a pretty different thing from working the line?
It was a very different thing. And again, I was young and I was managing people that were much older than me. I mean, there were waiters at that restaurant that were 65 and I was 24, 25, 26 at the time. And you know, for me, I think I've always been generally good at managing and that I'm very organized. I can see kind of the big picture. But at that time, like I said, I was this cocky kid and I thought something needed to happen, which really didn't need to happen. And I don't entirely blame myself. I think it was a lot of the situation. I was kind of in the wrong place. Like I shouldn't have been there. But I think generally in the kitchen, I didn't have that hard of a time managing because I had people working for me who really wanted to do well, and I wanted to do well. And I think we were, for the most part, on the same page. With that said, with the rest of the restaurant, I was kind of in charge of the restaurant. You know, I would work with the general manager. I was overseeing the waiters. And in retrospect, when I'm thinking about that, it's kind of laughable because by no means was I in the place to be able to do that properly. I didn't do a great job managing costs. You know, I was like, we're going to do this. We're going to make this happen. We need to do this. I really didn't understand the full picture at that point. Like until then, I hadn't done that. So they took a chance with me. And for what it's worth, like the restaurant did well and it was supported by this giant corporation. So it's not like anything really bad happened. But at the same time, It was definitely a learning experience, and I think that period in my life, not only professionally but personally, like was the biggest growth I've ever had. Like I just learned, like I was just being a jerk a lot of the time, and I realized that. And I don't think I've always been a nice person, but I think it's easy to, when you get in certain places, to let your experience get in the way of how you are as a person. All of a sudden, you become cocky and you don't even notice it. And you become pretentious and you really lose track of where you're at with things. And I think that really happened to me there.
Yeah. How do you feel like your sort of culinary aesthetic changed? Because those are very different styles of restaurants that you were working
in. Yeah. Well, that was the thing. Like
that'll, yeah. Anyway,
when I looked at some of the first dishes we were doing when I got back from Las Vegas, again, it was a joke. And I think that's a hard thing, particularly for young chefs. And you see it a lot now, especially with young chefs who work for very accomplished chefs. When they go somewhere else, their style, like they're basically doing exactly what they did at their other restaurant, and they're trying to really fit it into another place, and it doesn't work. And we, you know, it's funny because you see that a lot with folks who are trying to do like the Noma aesthetic in a place where it just doesn't really work. Like it's just not what it is. And I was trying to take these kind of like relatively like flashy kind of things and serve them in this like old school institution in Washington, D.C. And if you can imagine, it's kind of a joke. I will say, like, as time went on, from a cooking aesthetic, I think we figured it out and we started to serve food that made more sense. But I still was full of ego and still felt like we needed to be doing this, that, and the other thing, when realistically we could have been serving very simple, well-made dishes. You know, the folks that were eating in a restaurant like that, and this is common in a place like Washington. When people come to eat who are going to spend money, they want to eat. They don't want to be bothered. You know, they don't want someone at the table explaining wine for 30 minutes. They don't want that. They want food. They want a menu that's accessible. They want to order things that are expensive, actually. They want to be able to spend money. They want things prepared exactly how they want them prepared. They want the food to be hot if it's supposed to be hot. They want it to be cold if it's supposed to be cold. They just don't want stupid shit. Like, they just don't want that. They want it to be... And honestly, like, a lot of restaurants out there, again, because that's genuinely cooking for another person. Most, like, that's that kind of place. You are cooking for your customers. Most restaurants these days, you're the chef, you're cooking for yourself, and your customers come to eat that food. Yeah. So it's a very different way of thinking.
And you mentioned Noma, so let's go to that part of your career.
That was the next step. Yeah. So, you know, I like spun my wheels for 3.5 years at 1789, and I literally, I was like, I want to see, and I'm seeing like other people get press and all this stuff, and I'm like, you know what, I want to see if I can do, if I can actually hang at the highest level. That's like legitimately why I ended up at Noma. So I made a list of three restaurants. It was Noma, it was the Fat Duck, and it was Alinea. And my goal was to get to one of these restaurants and hopefully work my way up. So I wrote to all three. Alinea got back to me. Fat Duck never got back to me. And then Noma, strangely enough, somebody had gifted me the Noma book. And again, at 1789, I was kind of out of the loop. You know, it's funny, this 50 Best Awards became such a big part of my life when I was at Noma. But at the time, at 1789, I didn't know what that was. Like, I was working for a restaurant in Washington, D.C. Like, we weren't in the mix. You know what I mean? So someone gave me the book, the Noma book, and I was like, this is super cool. So I got interested in it, and that's why I had originally contacted Noma. So then I was, like, doing research, and I found out that a gentleman that I had worked at Oriole with when I was 23, or sorry, I was 18 at the time at Oriole, Matt Orlando, and he worked his way around New York City. He was the chef of Noma, like the head chef of Noma. So I kind of like rummaged around a variety of things and found his contact and wrote to him. And I was like, can I get a trial here? So he helped me get like a 2-week trial at Noma. Simultaneously, I was able to go spend a few days at Alinea. At Alinea, I just wasn't my fit. And then I went to Noma for 2 weeks. Meanwhile, this was like a vacation from 1789. Like, I was still working there as the chef. I went to Noma for 2 weeks on a trial. And this, the whole point of it was in anticipation of getting a job. So I spent 2 weeks there. And the 2 weeks were up. And then I just left. Like, no one talked to me. No one, like, said, hey, let's sit down and talk about you getting a job. I was just there for 2 weeks.
What was that 2 weeks like? What were you doing?
It was amazing. I mean, I was like, to paint a picture of what Noma is, you know, you have a lot of people there working as interns. And I essentially was kind of working as that function. And you have a lot of people working there. So you have about 25 to 30 people working there, full-time paid, and then about 25 people working there as interns. There's a tremendous amount of labor that goes into everything they do. So I remember when I was there for 2 weeks, for example, I was picking crab meat for a lot of the day and going through each, you know, so we had these like kind of dungeness type, these brown crabs basically, and you'd steam them and then pick the meat. But you'd have to pick through all the meat with tweezers to make sure there are no shells. In fact, at one point, the sous chef there was experimenting with a technique that you'd be in the walk-in cooler with the lights off, with a black light over the crab meat so you could see the shells. And that was like, he was trying that out that week, and I just happened to be there. So like, I spent a lot of time doing that.
In the walk-in fridge.
In the walk-in fridge that like every time someone needed to go in the walk-in, which was every 2 minutes,
yeah.
They turned the lights on, you had to stop. And then the lights went on and they closed it. And then you went back to work and trying to get the shells out. But, you know, the stuff I did there, it really reminded me of being in my first job where I was doing these like menial tasks, but I just loved it. Like my job at 1789 became so administrative and it was more about managing than cooking that this is kind of what I wanted. I was just going to be doing work. And, you know, I saw so much stuff. I saw 20 nationalities of people like just running around, people from all over the world
in the kitchen.
It was just crazy, and like the atmosphere and the energy was something I'd never seen in my life. And for what it's worth, when I put that on that list to go see it, as much as I was really interested in the aesthetic of food and that kind of fit what I liked, and I was interested to learn about a lot of new ingredients, the idea of like the best restaurant in the world, I was genuinely fascinated with that. What does that mean? What are the people like there? How do they carry themselves? How does it operate? And I will say, when I went there, I was not disappointed. I was like, wow. There was just this, it was just a different level. So I really wanted to go there. And again, no one said anything to me. So I just went back to DC and I was like, well, that sucks. So I wrote Matt an email. I'm like, I was just wondering, like, we had talked about this being like a trial, and he's like, yeah, we don't really have any jobs available now, and like, you need to get a visa, and that's really hard right now in the political climate for you to get an American to get a visa in Denmark and all that stuff. It's like, all right. I asked him, I said, if I move there and can get my own visa and work for free, is that okay? He said, yeah, if you really want to get your own visa and work for free, you can do that. So I put everything in motion. At the time, I had a girlfriend, I had a dog, I had a car, an apartment. Put my notice in Washington. And that, to this day, that's the most money I've ever made as a salary, was that job I had in Washington. Didn't have a paying job lined up in Denmark. My girlfriend at the time quit her job, got the dog. The dog got a passport. The dog has to get a passport because there's this whole like quarantine situation. And we got up and moved to Denmark, simultaneously figuring out the whole visas thing. And my girlfriend at the time was a Finnish citizen because of her mother. So through like rules of cohabitation, we had lived together for more than 18 months. I was able to share the same rights as her. So within 2 days of being in Denmark, I had a 5-year visa.
Had you figured all this out going in, or did this become?
Well, I didn't want to get too lengthy on it, but yeah. Literally in the prospect of going to Noma for 2 weeks with the off chance I'd get a job, I started looking into getting my Italian citizenship because my father was born in Italy. And that I went down like this wormhole with that where like, because my father naturalized before I was born, I couldn't get it through him, so I had to do it through my mother's grandfather, which meant you have to track, you know, birth and death of all these people there. So I was like on Ancestry.com. I hired a private investigator. It was like this crazy thing, wow. Which was really cool in the end. It was a good experience. I learned a lot. I know more about my family than anyone else. Never got my citizenship that way. I also started taking Berlitz Danish lessons every day.
Wow.
Live on my computer, and that's expensive. Like, if you've never done that, it was like a person every day, and it was like racking my brain because I thought if I could get a job, I would take an immigration test, which you had to take a language test. All this in the off chance, none of it came through, and like, it was just this thing that my girlfriend at the time had figured this out that we could do it, and it worked. Like, we didn't know if it worked. She got like all the documents together. We went there, and it was like clockwork. Like, we went there, they stamped it, and we left. It was like mind blown. So then I'm there and I literally, like, everything happened in such a strange way. Literally arriving in Copenhagen, Matt contacted me and he was like, are you coming? Like, is this going to happen? Are you going to be able to get a visa? I'm like, yeah, looks like it's all going to happen. And he's like, yeah, because someone just left. And this guy who ended up going to London, like, just abruptly left. Like, it was like this falling out. It was weird because it never happened in the whole time I was there. Like, it's not the place you just leave. And then there was an opening for like the lowest level job, like a paying position, which is a chef de partie. So that's like a cook, basically. So I'm living in Copenhagen, squared away, and now have a paying job, like just like that. And then it just started. It started working.
Let's pause right there.
Sure.
We're going to take a quick break. Yeah. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay
All
tuned.
Right.
This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Ball Factory, a Japanese eatery and coffee shop at 95 Montrose Avenue in East Williamsburg. Brooklyn Ball Factory uses the best ingredients to make Japanese comfort food, like their bento boxes featuring meatballs, grilled veggies, Japanese fried chicken, or pork shabu shabu. Plus, visit Brooklyn Ball Factory's sister restaurants, Momo Sushi Shack, Samurai Papa, Samurai Mama, Bozu, and Kitade Shokudo. Learn more at brooklynballfactory.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. Hi, my name is Sam Ben Ruby, and I'm the host of The Grape Nation on Heritage Radio Network. With this show, we bring wine to the people. Each week, we bring the best guests in wine on, taste different wines on air, and invite our listeners to taste with us. You'll find our approach to wine decidedly unsnobby. You can find The Grape Nation wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
I
And we're back. We're joined this week by Dan Giusti, Dan Giusti, who's the founder and CEO of Brigade and former head chef of Noma, which was just what he was about to tell us before we took the break. So
yeah,
go for it.
So again, here I am. Finally, I'm situated. I'm at Noma and I have a paying job. Again, I'm a chef de partie. So again, to put things into perspective, in a place like Noma at the time, it's a little different now. There was about 25 to 30 people who were working there full time, six or seven of which were head chef, sous chefs. And then there's Rene Redzepi, who it's his restaurant. He's the chef owner. And then everyone else is a chef de partie, which essentially is a cook. But in this case, you have a little more responsibility. You're running a lot of things on your own. And in this case, too, even though as a paid employee, you're kind of at the lowest level, there are about 25 to 30 interns working there voluntarily. So you're overseeing them as well. So even though you're at the lowest level, you are overseeing a lot of people. So there is some management responsibility there. So a lot of these cooks, like I was 27, 28, which at the time was a little on the older age. I will say it was a little bit of a young person's game. But still, when I left there, a lot of the cooks, the chef de parties were like 28, 29, 30. So it's a little different than, say, a cook, if you will, if you think about it here. But anyway, got a job. Started working on a station and, you know, just got right into it. Like, this was my life. I was going to be there. And we were working a lot. You know, it was like 7, 8 a.m. to midnight, 5 days a week. Restaurants closed twice a week. When the restaurants open there, you work. It's the same team in the kitchen. So waiters, they had shifts. But if you were a chef at the time, you worked when the restaurant was open, which I like that. I like that way of working. There's no shifts. You don't have to worry about this person knows this better than that person. But it really takes a toll on you. The pressure, as you can imagine, is immense. People flying in from all over the world for lunch. You know, people flying in for lunch and then flying back out. So the expectations are tremendously high. So I'm working there. I'm like kind of figuring it out. I will say that, like, again, my job at 1789 was very administrative. So I was like kind of rusty. And like people were running around. You know, like a lot of these young guns who are like 22, 23, they'd been interns all over the world and all these different restaurants. And like, I'd never done that. You know, the best restaurant I ever worked in was in Las Vegas and I was there for a year. So these people had seen all this stuff. And like, so I was a little out of my league. I won't lie, a little out of my league.
Was it hard from sort of an ego perspective, having come from an executive chef position in a fine dining restaurant?
You know, I think I was okay. Like, I would have done anything to get there. And I knew, like, one thing I've always, I think, been good at, even though I said at one point I was cocky and pretentious. Like, I think by that point, being at 1789 really like knocked me down a few pegs, like, because I really realized, like, what am I doing? Like, I think I'm better than I am. So I was willing to like throw my, so that wasn't too much of a problem. Like, I knew where I stood and I was okay with that. Like, I was just honestly, I was just happy to be there. And I will say, like, again, it was rough. Like, I didn't think I was doing a good job. I was really struggling. Like, my body was taking a pounding. I wasn't used to working that much. So then after about like 7 or 8 months of doing this, and like this flies by because you're just like working. You know, like I said, I moved there with my girlfriend at the time and she was having a hard time adjusting. Like, she gave up her job in Washington and then was working for the same company, but then remotely. And like, so she wasn't really meeting many friends. And so it came to this point where I was like, she wasn't happy. I was really struggling. And, you know, when we originally moved there, I was like, we might be here for like 3 months and leave because I might never get a job and we might run out of money or whatever. So it was like 7, 8 months and there I am already. Like, I don't know if this is going to work. Like, I don't even feel like I'm doing a good job here. Like, that's really what it came down to. Like, this is the best restaurant in the world. Like, I'm going to be the guy who like ruins that, even though I had like a little piece, you know, of the work. So I scheduled a meeting with Matt Orlando, who was still the head chef at the time. And I said, look, I'm struggling, you know, my girlfriend, she's having a hard time. And like in one swoop, it was like, we might have a position for your girlfriend doing like marketing. I mean, it's not really marketing, but kind of. And I'm leaving in a year and a half to open my own restaurant and we want you to become the next head chef. This was after like 7 or 8 months of being there and they were going to wait to tell me this. And I was still at like the bottom level.
So what was that? How did they make that decision? What did they see that...
You know, people have asked me this many times and like I've never talked to Matt about it really, or Rene for that matter. And I mean, I know the qualities that I have and I will say that It had nothing to do, you know, I would always tell people I was never the best chef there or the best cook there by any means. And I will say at the time, it was pretty crazy because there were a few sous chefs there who'd been there for some time who were amazing. And I have a tremendous amount of respect to this day. And so that was kind of interesting. And like I said, this was still far off. So from like, so it was kind of a no brainer. I was like, okay, it was the kind of thing you couldn't say no to.
Yeah.
So basically from that point for about a year plus, they groomed me to be the next head chef. So like just doing different things. They made me a sous chef at one point, and then they announced it that I was going to become the next head chef. And like Matt Orlando is like the golden child. Like Matt Orlando worked at the Fat Duck. Matt Orlando was a sous chef at Per Se, at the height of Per Se. Like he had just done a lot, and he's like the nicest guy you'll ever meet. He's like super cool. And like, so, and he was like this American who managed to become the head chef of Noma. Like he was the first head chef. They'd never had a head chef before. And then they were going to announce that I was going to become the next head chef. And I can just remember till this day, it was like crickets. Like it was like this meeting, they got everyone around, like, you know, as you know, Matt's going to open a new restaurant in a few months. And then Dan's going to become the next head chef. And it was like, people were like, what? Like people respected me and they liked me. But like, I think people were just like, yeah, I'm not quite sure what that decision's all about. And just fast forward, I'll go back to it, but it always makes me remember because when I announced who my replacement would be when I left Noma, it was like cheers. People were excited. And it just reminded me again. It was like, man, when they announced when I was becoming head chef, nobody really cared. So then that was that.
How did that feel?
It was like, again, I think part of why I became head chef, like I understood this whole thing. I wasn't expecting people to, I knew people were going to be like, this is weird. I knew that there were sous chefs there who would definitely feel as though they should have become the head chef and like, and had to be very sensitive to that. So in all this, basically leading up to becoming the head chef at the end of the year, there was like some turnover, not so much because I became the head chef. It was like a natural time where some of the sous chefs left to open their own restaurants. Matt had left, and some of the other guys who kind of started with me, then kind of rose up, became sous chefs. And we all came back in January, and I was the head chef of the restaurant now. There were new cooks, new chefs, and it was like we assumed the restaurant. And that year was so hard. It was so difficult. So again, on the 50 best list, we were number one. Noma at the time, and it still didn't have three Michelin stars, just two Michelin stars. But that February, we had a norovirus outbreak, which was, until this day, the worst thing that's ever happened to me in my career, where 60-some people got sick from eating at Noma. So you have people who are coming to Noma to get the best meal of their life, and then we make 65 people sick, and it was like horrible.
What happened?
So basically the way the whole thing transpired is it all happened like the week of Valentine's Day. So it was like February 14th, 15th, 16th. And I remember on a Monday, we got a couple calls. People were like, and we had a couple calls over the weekend that were left on a message. And they were like, oh, I got sick. I threw up. And like, oh, we didn't think too much of it. It was like one. We called them to see if they're okay and so on. And then we got a few more calls. At that point, we contacted the health department. And then simultaneously, a few people had contacted the health department directly and said we got sick. So over the course of a week, all these people called. So then the health department came. And, you know, this isn't public news. The health department came. And they didn't do a full-on inspection, but I sat down, Renee sat down with them, and we talked to them. And they were like, what could this be? Blah, blah, blah. And I had suggested maybe it was, you know, norovirus quite often comes from bivalves. Clams, oysters, mussels, if they're untreated, because filter feeders, it's in the water, it goes through. And I'd learned working at this restaurant as a younger person in Washington, because they had a very robust oyster program, we would get oysters and then we'd send them out to get tested for norovirus, and a lot of them would have it. And fisheries are not required to test for norovirus. They're required to test for E. coli and other bacteria. They're not required to test for norovirus. So, and if you don't know this, there's a lot of places around the world that are notorious during that season. It's like January, February. A lot of people actually get norovirus. And all it is, you know, it's you have diarrhea and you're throwing up. So people just don't even know it. Anyway, I said, maybe it's the mussels, because that was the only bivalve we were serving at the time. But it was cooked, but it wasn't like completely cooked. Most people, when they think mussels, you boil mussels. We had a preparation on the menu, though, that we were taking mussels and we were roasting them in a pan. And then they'd open, dry. I've never seen that before. But to kill norovirus, you have to get the internal temperature of the mussels very high. And I was like, I bet you we're not getting it that high. So I'm just telling you right now that it's probably the case that these mussels aren't cooked all the way through. So if they were contaminated, it could be a problem. Strangely enough, I find in retrospect that the guy, the health inspector we were talking to, actually had an article in the main newspaper in Denmark, in Copenhagen, how mussels are a really safe thing to eat. So I found that out after the fact. But anyway, he walks around the restaurant for 10 minutes, not even in his like proper uniform, basically goes to one of the three hand-washing sinks in the kitchen. Now, by law, we were only required to have one working hand-washing sink. One of them, this was a building that was several hundred years old, plumbing was old. The water took slightly too long to get hot. And that's all it took. That he wrote a report that said, X amount of people got sick here, and it's because of improper hand washing. They don't have hot water. Because of that one sink, it was so ridiculous. Didn't put any thought into this whole mussel thing. And then where does that report go? It's similar to here. That report goes directly on the front of the restaurant. Still not public. And it's in Danish. Most of our customers were English speaking. So it was like a ticking time bomb. So a week goes by, no one knows, no one says anything, even though it's right on the front of the restaurant that people got sick. And I remember one day coming out of the kitchen, because at Noma we used to serve all the food ourselves, coming out of the kitchen and taking a left, in the front of the restaurant, the door was right there. And these two guys came in all in black, and in Danish say, "We want to see the head chef." And they meant Renee.
Yeah.
But I knew immediately, I'm like, there it is. Here we go. It was, and they were representing the tabloid newspaper in Copenhagen. They sat down. The news had gotten out. By the end of that lunch, there were cameras lined up, video cameras, news people, literally interviewing people as they came out of the restaurant.
Are you feeling sick?
Yeah, yeah. Can you imagine that? Jeez. Nonetheless, Renee actually had been away. He was playing racquetball that day, and he stayed away for a couple of days because it was a problem. And he's like, "What do you think? Like, what do you think?" I'm like, "I'm telling you, it's these mussels. I don't care what anybody says. It's not to mention that kitchen was like immaculate. Like, we kept that kitchen spotless. You could eat off the ground in that kitchen." I'm like, "It's the mussels." I sent the mussels to get tested immediately to a local university. Nonetheless, all this transpired. All the newspapers picked it up. People are getting sick. I remember that night, I was like, "Are people going to show up tonight?" Everyone showed up. Everyone. We never lost business. People kept coming. But people would crack jokes every once in a while, blah, blah, blah. And then surely enough, a few weeks later, after all this had kind of transpired, mussels come back. They tested positive for norovirus. And at that point, Renee was like, "Should we go to the meeting?" Like, we're contemplating. We should go. And it was like, it had already kind of calmed down a bit. I was like, forget about it. But that happened. Horrible. Michelin Guide comes out. Still 2 Michelin stars. And then we go to the 50 best in May. And we go to number 2. And although the voting happened in October, so I technically had nothing to do with it as the head chef, all of us were like, yeah, we lost the number one spot in this restaurant. All of us. I remember in my time at Noma, every time we did the 50 best, I was the one who had to fly back the morning after the party, do the 50 best ceremony as a party after, and I would take a flight back from London at 4 in the morning and expedite the service for lunch the next day. And I remember going back that time, and we're like, we got number 2. It was like, I was like, are people just going to quit working here now? Is this because this is like the only reason they wanted to work here? It's been the best restaurant in the world. So this was just like brutal. Anyway, that continues. There's like a sense of like, we need to get this back. That summer was one of the MAD symposiums. So every year, Noma has a nonprofit called MAD, M-A-D, that does like a symposium where really all the biggest culinary figures in the world come to Copenhagen for this symposium to talk about a variety of things, but all those people end up eating at Noma too. So like at any given point in time in the rest, like there were nights at Noma during the symposium where literally every single table, there's 12 tables, would be like every single idol you ever had in your life in the culinary world sitting there. To the point that I remember, like, we had, I forget what's her name. What's the woman who's from the H2O movies? Halloween movies, the woman, what's her name, the actress, I can't even remember her name. I saw this yesterday.
No idea.
Anyway, we had a point where that week we had all these famous chefs eating, and she was eating, and like no one cared. She was like, she was the only one that was not like noted as an important person. And it was like, you know, Alain Ducasse ate there while I was there. Ferran Adrià ate there while I was there. All these people ate there. And that week after this had happened, this was a few months, this is in August after this, this 50 best thing happened, we just crushed it. People were like angry. Like, we were so aggressive. We wanted things to be the best. And then surely enough, the following year we got number one back. And that, to me, that was like the culmination of like my time at NOMA. Like, we lost it, we got it back, we were on track. Like, then things kind of fell into place as the head chef, and things went. And, you know, a couple years passed after that of just like, you know, working in this restaurant that was considered the best in the world. And I loved it. I thrived on that. I, you know, I worked every day, you know, 18 hours a day, and loved it and enjoyed it. But
let's make sure we have enough time to talk about Brigade. We only have 10 minutes left. Let's talk about that transition. How did you decide to start Brigade, and what is it, and how have you taken everything you've done in your career?
Yep. So then it was time to go. It was time to leave, not because I didn't like NOMA, because it just takes a toll on you, and it was time to move on and give someone else that opportunity to become the head chef. So when it was time to decide what I wanted to do, by that time I had a lot of confidence in myself, and I knew I could do whatever I wanted to do. And I didn't want to open a restaurant. I had no desire to open a restaurant. And I thought back of what I used to, kind of what got me into cooking in the first place. And again, it was this idea of like hospitality, taking care of people, really feeding people, which I think is a very different thing than, say, like working in a restaurant. Because the thing is, it's this idea, again, I think there's two ways you can think about cooking. You can cook for yourself, you can cook for other people. So for me, it was about cooking for other people. I knew I wanted to cook for a lot of people, but maybe even more importantly, I knew I wanted to cook for a lot of people every day. You know, in a restaurant, you don't have the opportunity to do that. You don't cook for people every day. So when you're cooking for people every day, it becomes much more of a practical thing. You know, it's not like this, you know, because if you're cooking for people every day, you have to take into consideration the health repercussions, the nutritional repercussions of what you're feeding them, as well as price. Obviously, if you're cooking for them every day, it's not some blowout thing. This is a way that a lot of chefs don't want to cook. They don't want to have to think about all this, you know, they want to be able to cook whatever ingredients they want to cook, and they don't want to think about like nutritional guidelines. For me, I wanted to cook for a lot of people, so you have to think about these things. And then I realized that going into kind of the institutional food route was the way to go, because in institutional food, whether it's a school, whether it's a hospital, a senior care center, whether it's a prison, you're cooking for a lot of people, you're cooking for them every day. Also, you're cooking for a group of people that really needs good food and traditionally do not get it. And then beyond that, like from a responsibility standpoint, I knew I wanted to feed a lot of people and I wanted to cook a lot of food. The idea of like opening another like fast casual restaurant, there's like already millions of them, and cook just more food. I don't care how responsible you are. If you open a restaurant today or a fast casual place today, you're just adding more food waste. You're just doing it. Like, there's no way around it. So I wanted to do something at volume. So the way I thought about it was like, why don't I go to a place that's already making food and it's just shit and just make it better? So this is how I got into the whole institutional food thing. And then for me, even though we're still considering all these other spaces, schools was the way to start. The idea of being in a school, feeding kids who really need it most, and really getting kids when they're young and getting them to think differently about food was something very intriguing to me. So when it was time to leave NOMA, I literally said, this is what I'm going to do. All I knew is I wanted to put chefs into schools, and that was it. I told Renee I was going to leave and do this. He was blown away and super supportive. You know, I'd seen many chefs leave there and then come back. I'd seen many chefs want to leave and he persuaded them to stay. He never did that with me. As soon as I said I wanted to go and wanted to do this, he believed in it.
Where did the school food idea come from?
I think, well, when I was looking at institutions in general, again, the idea of being in a school, particularly because, I mean, it's all about the kids. There's nothing else. Schools, it doesn't even matter, but it's the kids, it's that you're cooking for young people. And I think the more I looked into institutional food in general and researched it a bit, the complications that are rooted within school food particularly, again, was this thing that I was like, this is crazy, like this is really hard. And it just kind of like struck a chord with me, like I want to work on this and try to figure this out. I think the more I got into it, the more I realized there was a lot of challenges to it. I also realized that a lot of those challenges could be solved by chefs, and there are not a lot of chefs in school food, or at least chefs that they're in the prime of their career. There are a lot of chefs, don't get me wrong, there are chefs who do this that do a very good job, but there are a lot of chefs who it's like the end of the road for them. They're kind of like tired and they just like want weekends off and work a little bit less. So they just like get into working in schools, and like, it's a really tough problem. So you need people who are really motivated and ambitious to do it. So I basically said I was going to do this. The Washington Post wrote like a profile on it. This was December of 2015. My last day at NOMA was the end. The last day of 2015 was New Year's Eve. I came back to the United States, and because of that article, loads of people around the country wrote to me. And one of them was the superintendent of New London Public Schools, which is this small town in Connecticut. And after going there, I said, let's start here. So it's this town, it's 25,000 people, 1 in 4 people are under the poverty line. It's a town that exemplifies this idea that the disparity between poverty and wealth in Connecticut is the highest in the country. It's this little town surrounded by all these affluent areas. The superintendent was super smart. He got it. He understood how things were going to work. And that's a big reason why I went there as well. 6 schools, about 4,000 students. And essentially, we just started in a very basic way. I went out, advertised to hire chefs. We got tons of applications from all over the country for people to move to New London, Connecticut, to work in a school. We hired chefs to work in each of their schools. And essentially, and that's kind of what we do, in a nutshell, is take what was primarily a heat and serve operation. You know, they were very organized, did a very good job. The food service director there who ran, you know, she still does, runs the program. She's amazing. But there's just limitations. Like, if you're not a chef, like, how do you expect people to do this? So we went there and we transitioned what was, again, primarily heat and serve processed food to scratch cooking. And, you know, just to put it into perspective and context, essentially, if you are working in a public school in the United States and you want to get money from the government for your food, which most schools opt to do, you opt into a program called the National School Lunch Program. So very basically, if you participate in the National School Lunch Program, you produce a meal that fits very strict nutritional guidelines. These are the guidelines that were implemented in 2010 under the Obama administration. And if you make that meal under those guidelines, they give you a certain amount of money back. So for lunch this year, if you produced a meal that fit those guidelines, you got $3.39 back. $3.39, though, is for everything. There's a misconception of this. People think that's just for the food. That's for everything. So that's for food, that's for labor, that's for maintenance, that's for if you have a truck that transports food, if it breaks down, whatever. So you're left with about $1 to $1.25 for the food itself. You have to offer 5 components. It's a protein, a whole grain, a fruit, a vegetable, and a milk you have to offer. Milk costs about a quarter in most places. So if a kid takes milk, you're down to $1 for the meal. So the real challenge is, from a food perspective, is making a meal from scratch, from whole ingredients, for $1 that fits very strict nutritional guidelines that are very complicated and they take time to measure. And then, more importantly, and the hardest thing, is to get kids to actually like that food. And that's really where there's a lot of things out there right now that, to me, don't make a tremendous amount of sense. Because, again, and we struggled with this in the beginning. When we first started, we were making these meals for these kids, and we were like, yeah, we're like patting ourselves on the back. Like, we made this meal, and it fits the guidelines, and it fits the budget, and then kids wouldn't eat it. So, like, what does it matter at that point? Like, you can talk about that. You can put that on social media. You can show off. The kids don't eat it. What are you even doing in the first place? You know?
So what have you gotten kids to eat? Like, what's the trick? What's the solution?
Well, I think the trick is it takes time, first of all. You're not going to do it overnight. I think you have to throw kids a bone every once in a while and balance things. So, like, for example, I was talking to someone the other day about this. Like, we've made whole wheat, 51% whole wheat cinnamon buns, and we serve them for breakfast. Yeah,
you posted a picture on Instagram. Yeah.
Every once in a while. And people are like, that's crazy that you do that, because that's not healthy. We do it every once in a while. It's for the kids. And like, when they eat that and they see that, this is a tactic, you know, that they trust you, they believe in you. If you're just shoving food at them that they don't really like, and it's just all the time, they're never going to trust you with anything. So, like, for example, another tactic is providing a wide variety so kids are comfortable at any given point in time. So, for example, we took peanut butter and jelly sandwich off the menu. Again, an ego thing. I was like, I don't want this to be a crutch for kids. But then you realize that, like, again, first and foremost, the National School Lunch Program and what we do in schools is a feeding program. There's no way around it. It's an unfortunate fact that there are a lot of kids out there that will not eat if they don't eat at school. So we really came to the point where our egos got so big that we were taking things that off the menu that essentially were the one thing that kids wanted to eat. And then they would choose not to eat, as they have that right, which is another sentiment that people have out there, that, like, if you're hungry, you should just eat whatever's given to you, which obviously is bullshit. Everybody has the right to decide what they're going to eat. So we took peanut butter and jelly sandwich off the menu, and then all of a sudden kids, like, there would be kids, and they'd just, like, put their head down and not eat. And when you see that, you're like, oh, my God, what are we doing? So we have peanut butter and jelly sandwich on the menu. Then working our way up, we have pasta dishes. So pasta dishes we see are something that a lot of kids who maybe are not ready to try more ambitious things, they're down for. And they're hot meals. So instead of eating a peanut butter and jelly sandwich every day, now I'm going to eat pasta. So pasta with bolognese and some warm garlic bread, or pasta with Alfredo sauce and some warm garlic bread. And then we get into, like, the more ambitious meals. Some are more ambitious, some aren't. Like, our mainstay meal from the beginning that's worked since day one is we took chicken patties, chicken nuggets, all these things off the menu. We put whole pieces of chicken. So it's chicken thigh with bone-in skin on. So barbecue chicken, warm cornbread, and potato salad. A hit from the beginning. Make it for a dollar. We've done chicken curry with brown steamed rice, steamed brown rice, and roasted sweet potatoes. That's the kind of meal that's probably middle of the road. Half the kids are really about it. Half the kids aren't. We have a hummus dish we do. That it's probably my favorite dish we do, but we serve it very sparingly because, again, it's very polarizing. Hummus with a variety of vegetables, smoked paprika on top, a vinaigrette made from za'atar. And because of the nature of the dish, we can assemble all of that. And then during the service of lunch, we can make flatbread to order. So it's warm flatbread with the hummus, and it's delicious.
Sounds amazing.
It's great. Like, honestly, if you saw it, you could charge $15 anywhere. But anyway, again, we realize that the most important thing is to offer variety. The most important thing you can do is really watch the kids eat, take care of the kids, and you can't get caught up in what you think is best. And there's a lot of folks out there that feel like we are the adults, we're the professionals, we understand what's good for the kids. And I get that. I understand that completely. We can't just let kids eat whatever they want because they might just eat cookies and chips. But you can't go the other way either. You can't just cook whatever you want. You have to start somewhere. And if you don't start there, I don't think you'll ever get them. And then what are you doing?
Yeah.
You never get anywhere.
I wish we could talk for another hour, but unfortunately our time is almost up. Where can our listeners read more about your work, learn more about the brigade? And
I mean, we have a website, chefsbrigade.com. I have an Instagram account that's just my name, dan.giusti. And then we also have an Instagram account that's Brigade. And quite honestly, a lot of what we're posting currently on a day-to-day is on Instagram. We're a small company, but if you check it out, I think you'll see a lot more about what we're up to.
All right, great. And as always, you can reach us, yfood@heritageradionetwork.org. You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook @yfoodpodcast. You can reach me via my spice company, Burlap and Barrel, @burlapandbarrel on Instagram. And Valerie, my temporarily absent co-host, is @foodieinnewyork. Thanks to Amanda, our awesome sound engineer, and to the Red Crickets for our theme song, which is Blind. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And yeah, see you next week. We were face to face and back to my back. Went to a place that only I can know. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.